Welcome back to the Mutica Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Brian Hartman.
Doing my second intro in 20 minutes. As a professional podcaster who forgot to hit record.
Here at the Mutica Movie Club, we've been doing this for several years, and what we do here is we, a group of friends, select three movies every month to watch together and post written reviews on MuticaMovie.club. And we get together at the end of the month to discuss those three movies on this Mutica Movie Club podcast. What we've never done is forget to record as we're talking. That streak ends tonight because it's not the worst thing in the world. We talked for like 15 minutes on The Devil All the Time, one of our three movies for the month of December. But I just realized that I hadn't hit the record button. So real quick catch up. Devil All the Time and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Wonder Woman 1984 were the three movies we chose to talk about in December. We were in the middle of discussing The Devil All the Time, a movie that up to this point, if I can summarize our back and forth, we both think is unnecessarily mean to its characters. The movie is led by Tom Holland, better known as, or who Brian has thus far been referring to as Spider-Man because he's bad at actors. Stay tuned for our movie game. And there's way too much going on. There's layers and layers of plot that are wildly unnecessary. And Brian was just now talking about one of those characters played by Robert Pattinson. He is an oily preacher who seduces the stepsister of Tom Holland. You were saying, Brian.
I was saying that he is playing like a front of a character preacher pulling a ruse on this town or using this to seduce women, so he could do whatever accent he wants. In terms of accents, though, because this is Appalachia,
sure.
You and I, having been born in southern Indiana, you get like a little bit of this down there, and I wonder if we just don't hear it as bad.
I think that's possible. There's not a tremendous amount of movies that are made in this specific zone of the country, but when I do find something specifically about Appalachia, and it's often a documentary, There's definitely an accent there that I wouldn't necessarily say I recognize, but there is that, at the same time, there is that broad Midwestern accent that doesn't even sound like an accent. Maybe to most people it does. Who knows? I don't feel like I have an accent.
Until you go teach in the suburbs of Chicago for a year and students come up to you between classes and say, "Mr. Hartman, I can't understand what you're saying in class."
I can't even imagine that. I would interpret that as I'm talking too quickly or I'm mumbling, not that I'm saying words in a certain way.
No, it was a little slow, and I used to not ever pronounce short E's, but ever since that conversation with students, I've learned to use short E's. I've learned in general that your southern Midwesterner uses long vowels for everything.
Fascinating. There you go. If I had remembered to press record, the listener would have heard us say that neither of us are that good at judging accents. But this is a movie that is larded with heavy, performative, showy accents. And going back to Robert Pattinson's character, at a certain moment in this movie, Tom Holland's grandmother, he's an orphan. He plays a teenage kid. His grandmother gives the new preacher, played by Robert Pattinson, a dish of chicken livers. The narrator describes Tom Holland's grandma as being renowned for being an excellent cook. And Robert Pattinson's first act as preacher is to pick up her dish of livers, breaded chicken livers, which looks perfectly fine. I never even tried a chicken liver. I wouldn't choose to. That was always a choice at Grandy's that I never would have gotten anywhere near to.
I wonder if I'd like them now.
I don't know. You'd have to really talk me into that. But he humiliates her in front of everybody as like his inductory act as a preacher. And the town doesn't immediately like turn on him. This supposedly like honor-based society that would really take those kind of slights personally. I felt like I had expectations from that moment and many other moments in The Devil All the Time that the movie didn't fulfill, not because I'm some expert in Appalachia, but I think more so because the movie had no understanding of these characters.
Well, I took it more as like a reverence for the authoritative position in the church.
But surely this region would know a thing or two about traveling ministers coming through who may or may not be con men, like just setting up a tent somewhere. People would surely do that fairly regularly. Like, you have your regular preacher, and then you have, like, preachers just coming through, and they would be able to tell who was a good one and a bad one, and who was trying to pull one over on the town and who wasn't. Especially because the movie's interpretation of this community is that it's the first, second, and third thing on their minds is their relationship with this Old Testament God. I thought that was going to be a really great scene. I thought he was going to totally charm that family because there are only so many characters in this movie, and a guy that immediately recognizable as despicable is, if he's going to seduce anybody, it's going to be the named actress who is directly related to the main character. But instead, he absolutely humiliates the grandma to the point where she's in tears. And the daughter hangs out with him anyways after that.
I think he had clout as, like, permanent substitute.
He was going to be the new preacher recommended by the old preacher.
So, like, who... Yeah, I mean, like, okay, so preacher's coming to town. It's the new guy. And he's going to be there for however many months or years. I think people were trying to defer to him. Yeah, like, I don't know. I just think it has to do with an authority in the church position where people don't necessarily question what the authority in the church is doing.
I think, again, not being an authority, but I think of Appalachian types as, like, fiercely independent, who are not the type to be taken advantage of. Who are, like, on the prowl for any kind of person trying to take whatever they have. Maybe that thinking is incorrect and informed by narratives that don't have, like, the full scope. I feel like they're not savvy in the sense of, like... Well, yeah, savvy. I think of Appalachians as savvy.
Right.
This movie thought of them as rubes, which I think is what the average coastal person thinks of the Appalachian... as, like, it's full of rubes, just mainly because they're religious first and foremost. But I don't know, there's lots of different kinds of rubes. I just had an angry conversation about psychics last Sunday, and not amongst, you know, Nebraskans, amongst people who would otherwise claim themselves to be, like, sophisticated liberals. So yeah, there's lots of different kinds of rubes.
I didn't get the feeling of rubes at all. And I don't think the mother or grandmother position, I don't necessarily think she was that intertwined in the church. Like, they sort of lived in the outskirts by themselves. They weren't part of the town community who's there.
I think they were recognized as, like, on the fringes economically, but still a part of the community. And the narrator knows everything. The narrator knows what characters are thinking. The narrator is inside their heads. So when the narrator says everybody loves their cooking, I have to interpret that as true.
True.
Yeah.
Where was the sense of community in this movie?
It was non-existent. Totally non-existent.
They must have all been on Twitter.
Yeah. Like we said, they're savvy. That, like, in my review, I compared this movie to the movies of directors like Jeff Nichols, who directed Mud and Take Shelter, and also the movies of Deborah Granik, who it takes place in the Ozarks, but I think this movie was, like, tonally similar to, like, Winter's Bone. And both of those directors have a tremendous amount of respect for everybody who shows up on camera. From the main characters to the extras in the background, which they probably cast from the local community. If they're even extras, they might just be people who live there, and Deborah Granik thinks they look interesting, and they're in a movie now. I'm thinking specifically of the scene in Winter's Bone, my favorite scene in the movie, when Jennifer Lawrence's character is looking for information about where her father is, and she stops by, like, like a family get together at night, not her family, but a different family, and the grandma is singing, and presumably her like sons and her grandsons are playing instruments around her and just listening very intently to her singing this old Ozarks backwoods folk song. And it's beautiful and it's perfect. And it's just a clear evocation of like what is valuable to this community. And it gives you a sense of history and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If anybody was going to have a scene like that, it would be a movie set in Appalachia. It would be this movie. But it's not this movie because it has no connection to the period it's set in or the people that it supposedly cares about. It's totally lacking in, as you said, those scenes of community that would give the characters a reason to want to stay. Because as it exists in The Devil All the Time, it's get me the fuck out of here. It's awful. There's no redeeming qualities about this place. Not a single fucking one.
Right.
Really irritating. Did not like The Devil All the Time. This is a C- for me. I did like Tom Holland. Yeah, I'd say he was well cast. He just has an insolent-looking quality to him while also being physically capable enough to like dole out some serious beatings.
Right. Yeah, I thought he and sister, grandparents, Spider-Face Preacher, and the Spider-Face Preacher's wife, Tom Holland's dad. Like, again, that whole line of the story I thought was well done and should have been famous. Well, not initially, really well done.
Yeah, I like
his... had some potential there. It was on the verge of being a good movie.
Yeah, his dad, he theoretically, if you just look at the bare facts of the movie, transforms a lot. Like, he goes from a jaded soldier who saw some terrible shit in the Pacific Theater in World War II to meeting this waitress, and then he's like insanely religious after a period of time. And like it would have just been nice to see that transformation as opposed right. to the movie just telling you this is what it is. Like we see him not participating in church, and then all of a sudden he's got like a makeshift cross in the background that is like his pseudo pagan altar that repeat he crucifies a family dog on. Final thoughts on Devil All the Time, Brian?
I don't know what my grade was. C- sounds about right. The more I think about the side story with the road tripping serial killers, the more annoyed I get.
Okay. Between rounds, or between movies here at the Mediocre Movie Club, we play the movie game, so named because we're bad at naming things. We have, as a group, a giant Excel Google spreadsheet of all the movies we've watched and graded over the years. The number it's at right now is 4,023 movies. So we get a random number generator to spit out a number. It just spit out number 3906. I always start. I name an actor from this movie, and then the next person names a movie that actor is in, and so on and so on and so on until we run out of names. Brian, who if I hadn't have said the actor's name, would have just referred to Spider-Man being the lead of The Devil All the Time.
Which Spider Preacher, very difficult to understand.
It was, I think it got cut off in the period we didn't record, but that was confusing. Yes, you're right to say so. but the movie that we selected is Despicable Me 3. I like those movies. I gave it a B-. And I'm going to say Steve Carell. So now you have to name a movie that Steve Carell is in.
But I can't say The Office.
No, you cannot.
He was in the 40-year-old version.
He was, and so was Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen was in the Pickle movie.
I'll accept that, just to keep the game going.
You have to, because you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I do, yes. He was in American Pickle.
I had it.
Yorma Taccone was in that movie, and I feel like we're going to go ahead and move on to the next movie.
I've never heard that name in my life.
He is one of the Lonely Island guys. Okay, yeah, I'll take that around. Yorma Taccone, of course, he wore the robot DJ head in Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping, among other things. He was also in Hot Rod, a vastly underrated movie.
I watched Hot Rod this summer.
It's great. Cool beans.
It was not a great movie.
You're wrong to say that. Our next movie is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Denzel Washington has created a deal with the estate of August Wilson, the playwright, the black playwright, to adapt six of his plays. The first one of these was Fences from 2016, Oscar nominated. Did Viola Davis win for that? I think she did. I can't remember. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is the second August Wilson adaptation, although Denzel Washington did not direct, as he did with Fences. This is directed by a theater veteran named George C. Wolfe. This movie is about Ma Rainey, who was a jazz age songstress. And the movie takes place in a recording studio where she is going back and forth with her manager and her producer while her band splits time between the recording studio and the rehearsal room, where they talk about their past and how they see their interactions with white people. Brian, what did you think of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
I felt like I was trapped in a room for an hour and a half. That was awful. The last trap movie I remember is the one where Tom Hanks is in the airport. Only this
one. Sure. The Terminal.
This one felt much more claustrophobic. I listened to a podcast about movies, or a YouTube video, for the first time in a long time that had to do with Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Kevin Smith and some other guy. And the other guy talked about how he's not going to just shit on movies anymore. He's going to try to think about what could have been done better. And I really like that concept. I felt like in this one, they're telling Ma Rainey's story, but you never really got to know her other than from a concert at the beginning. And so I don't know if she was just having a bad day or like that all the time. She was just so mean to everyone except for the guy with a stutter the whole time.
Who was like her nephew.
Yeah. I don't really know where any of these characters came from and had no attachment to them. And if I hear 1, 2, you know what to do one more time, you know, I'll lose my mind. That was at the beginning. What's that movie, the YouTube video, or not YouTube, because he uses Vimeo. The movie, the 2020 review.
Sure, David Ehrlich's.
David Ehrlich. He started that whole thing with the 1, 2, you know what to do, and I nearly shut the thing off.
This movie did not appear in that top 25 from David Ehrlich, one of the highlights of the cinematic year. I thought this movie was fine. I think without Viola Davis playing Ma Rainey, this movie would have serious problems of interest and stakes. She is really going for it. Like, she's doing a physical transformation kind of deal that might very well net her a second Oscar. She looks bad. I think full stop bad in the movie, which is purposeful.
You can tell it's hot and miserable.
Yes.
Not enough movies do that. This is the dead of summer in Chicago before air conditioning. It had to be awful. And she did a good job of showing that.
Yeah. Heavy makeup that is running, sweaty. She sits, she just holds herself like she is hot. Viola Davis is an actress, an actor who, famously, when it's time for her to cry and on a scene, she's really going to cry. Her nose is really going to run. And I don't think she ever cries in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but there's plenty of other secretions. It's as unpleasant as she is physically to be in the room with. I think she's really commanding. I'm totally with her as far as why she is such an asshole to everybody, especially her manager and the producer. Again, I didn't read that much about the real Ma Rainey, but in addition to getting the physicality right, she was an early semi superstar, and she has to really fight her white manager and her white producer every step of the way to get just basic writer contract type stuff. I want this and I want this and I want this. I'm going to make you a lot of money. Why are you fighting me at every turn? And the movie would say, obviously, because because she's black and they're white. And she does get what she wants eventually. And she's just figured out a way to make white people do what she wants. And I think that's what's going down in the recording studio half of the movie as well, where these less powerful, by far, bandmates are also negotiating how to get what they want from white people. There's three older guys, and Chadwick Boseman in his final role as the younger trumpeter. They're like get along types. They don't ask for a lot. They're pretty amenable. Whereas Chadwick Boseman puts on a very subservient face while plotting his big moment. In a way that he matches up with his family's history, which is pretty brutal and bloody. And I don't know. We got to talk about the ending, where that you're right doesn't include Ma Rainey at all. Like, the ending is Chadwick Boseman's character Levy having stabbed one of his bandmates after being told by the record producer that, no, in fact, we're not going to buy your songs and your plans are not going to work out, at least not right now. And in a fit of anger, he stabs Glenn Turman's character, who is a drummer, I think. I don't know. I really didn't like the ending.
That didn't make any sense.
The movie does not have a level of volatility or unpredictability that would make that moment as powerful as the movie clearly wants it to be. It kind of is just a thing that happens. Chadwick Boseman, rest in peace. You know, he's been getting a lot of praise for this movie. I don't think he's that good. I think he's just doing a lot of acting, and I don't think he's well suited for the period. I think he was better in Five Bloods, and I like this movie better than that one.
He was fine. He was playing a character, but again, we had no attachment to his character other than like one brief moment where you saw him playing the trumpet really well and upsetting Ma Rainey at a concert at some point, and then they're back together and she seemingly hates him.
Yeah, he's just not the most interesting part of the movie, and the movie needed to be more tilted towards Ma Rainey, because Viola Davis is suited to this era in a way that, I mean, she just might be that much better of an actor than Chadwick Boseman that she can fit in anywhere. He's done plenty of period movies. She's done plenty of period movies. I just didn't buy him in the role in a way that I did kind of everybody else.
Right, and she's missing for the middle half of the movie. Like, she's late to show up, and it's just these four guys trapped in a small room, you know, shooting shit.
And the big climax happens after she leaves. She leaves the building, and then the big climax happens. And then the final scene is Levy's songs being adapted by a lifeless white band. So the movie wasn't really about Ma Rainey in the first place. The movie, by leaving you with that, you know, pretty strong image, the arc of it is more about what happens to Levy, what happens to his dreams and his goals. And well, he fucking killed a guy, so I guess I'll take those $5 now for the songs. It just comes out of nowhere. I refer to it as like leftist 101, where oppressed classes fight amongst each other instead of fighting their oppressor. That's a totally fine point to make in a movie, but it should probably come a little earlier than a fit of just out of nowhere peak in the final minutes of a movie. Upstairs, recording studio, solid stuff. Downstairs, warm-up room, I could take it or leave it.
Right. I felt trapped. I wanted out.
I mean, do you say that negatively, the feeling of claustrophobia?
Well, I
sometimes feel like movies do go for that kind of thing, and they're like trying to generate negative emotions and like really transmit those kind of like feeling what the characters are feeling. And it surely was claustrophobic down there.
Right. But I think you can feel claustrophobic and relate to a character also feeling claustrophobic or, you know, a pot of water about to boil over when he, you know, stabs a guy. But that wasn't happening. I just felt like I was tired of listening to
it. I think that is totally fair. Play adaptations, I don't know. I don't usually like these kind of movies. The play adaptations that I do like something like Rabbit Hole, which was a movie from 2010 that was on my top 100 of the decade. You wouldn't have any idea that that movie was based on a play. It's not filmed like it is. It's easy to imagine Ma Rainey's Black Bottom playing out on a stage. And they're just different mediums. Like, I feel like Viola Davis, with her physicality, is in a movie. Because you wouldn't get how uncomfortable she looks if you were sitting in, the 20th row of a theater, watching her on stage. Chadwick Boseman, he's in a play, because he's yelling and screaming. And he's trying to talk to the back row. And they're just different.
Your choices for a play are either film the play itself and not mess around with it, or make it a bigger story. Like, if you look at Les Mis or Chicago or West Side Story, you take a play and you make it huge. You don't. It's not just some minor modification. And I felt like this was taking a play and expanding it to a second stage rather than a whole movie.
Yeah, if anything, this movie made me like Fences more. Because Fences is, you know, we mentioned that it's also a play adaptation, but there's just so much more life in it. It feels bigger.
It's bigger. That's exactly right. It gets bigger.
Yeah, and that movie's not lacking for big performances either, but Denzel Washington just has a better handle on them than George C. Wolfe, who again is a theater director, and they're different mediums. You got to add something to it. Anything else on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
Another lackluster 2020 movie.
I agree. I completely agree. I'm 0 for 2 on trying to select a movie for our next round of the movie game. Let's see what number 3837 is. One of our members, Chris Cook, puts a lot of horror movies that probably don't even get released in theaters. Come the fuck on, man. The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer. 0 for 3. I mean, strangely enough, that's not that at all. That's from 1947. Cooker, you're all over the place. 332 worked, which is The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. One of the all-time greats. We do. Me, Shane, and I, and Pierce as well. We do love that movie. And Brad Pitt is the Jesse James part of that equation.
So I have to name a Brad Pitt movie?
You do indeed.
Fight Club.
Ed Norton?
Oh, goodness. He's so famous. An Ed Norton movie. This is embarrassing a little bit. You know what would be fun is to count up how many Ed Norton movies I've actually seen. That's great.
You can do it. I'll tighten all this up in editing, so it'll be like you just came up with it right away.
I just don't know.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, you know, maybe next round we'll go back and forth a couple times.
Tell me some famous Ed Norton movie.
American History X, Primal Fear. He was in The Incredible Hulk. He was the Hulk for a brief period. What else? Birdman. A lot of Wes Anderson movies. Moonrise Kingdom. Oh. Our final movie is Wonder Woman 1984, sequel to 2017's Wonder Woman. One of the highest grossing movies from that year, and the first movie that pretty much everybody could agree from DC superhero extended cinematic universe was any good at all. Directed by Patty Jenkins, starring Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman / Diana Prince. The sequel takes place in 1984 and is about wishes. Brian, what did you think of Wonder Woman 1984?
All right, to reference the Kevin Smith YouTube podcast.
Sure.
The movie itself is not good, and there's so many things you can point out that were disjointed or poorly done with CGI or ways it could be redone. However, Kevin Smith spent an enormous amount of time talking about all the things that got pulled from the comic books and things that his daughter loved. And I'm just going to assume that his daughter reads the comic books because that's probably what they do as a family. And he had a lot of good things to say about how it made him and his daughter feel. And it made me hate the movie much, much less. Like, I'm okay not liking it, but I'm not as okay talking bad about all the things that happened in it when he starts to tell you about what the comic book meant to him and his world. So, there we go.
I don't feel that way. I thought this movie was a wholesale disappointment. Like, I don't love the original Wonder Woman. I think that movie was really close to being inventive and like breaking the form of comic of superhero movies, a form that like desperately needs to be broken because we've been living in it for going on 12 years, 13 years, if not longer. That's just going back to the Marvel movies. But, like, there's a moment in that movie when you think there's not going to be a bad guy, like a big bad guy, and there's not going to be a CGI flurry of meaningless punches, and then there is, and the movie kind of surrenders to the formula.
Someone said that they had the director rewrite the end of that
to make. I haven't read into of the original.
Yeah,
to make that would not surprise me. The movie. I think that movie really clearly wants to end after Wonder Woman kills Danny Houston's character, who is just a human who's like snorting some really good coke, and is able to put up a sad but reasonable amount of resistance to her. And then, you know, a Greek god of war shows up. In the sequel, it kind of does exactly what I wanted the original to do, but it does it with so many, like, logic leaps, and the movie asks you to buy into so much stuff that at the very end, when there is not really a big back and forth blowout and Wonder Woman is just talking the villain into surrendering, that's kind of what I wanted from the first one. But the sequel is so silly and so childish and so meaningless ultimately that I could not give a shit. It's 2.5 hours for some reason. Some of that crazy shit, I imagine it's about wishes. There's a magic rock that people wish on, and that's kind of the movie. You get the wish, but you have to give something up. And the villain, played by Pedro Pascal, in a pretty obvious but not terrible Donald Trump ripoff, I think it's appropriate for the era of like the mid 80s. He becomes the stone himself, so he's able to convince people to wish for stuff, and then takes what he wants from them. That whole dynamic was never clear. There's a magic gust of wind that shows up every time a wish is made. It's just so, so, so stupid. I think the average viewer has an expectation when it comes to these superhero movies that they're going to be for all audiences, in like this movie is going to at least attempt to not talk down to any section of its audience, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like you could sit a person who has some level of buy-in on into any Marvel movie, and they're not going to be like, this is for kids. That's not always the case, but I think it's mostly the case. Like, a lot of Marvel fans, like, it stretches the gamut from like 5 to the elderly, I would think. I can't imagine this movie appealing to anybody who is younger than, like, or who's older than 16. I just don't get it. I don't get it. Now,
I think it might appeal to people who, like, or they have a soft spot for Wonder Woman.
Yeah, but, like, what does Wonder Woman do in this movie? She is hung up on a romance that lasted, like, a week with the first man she ever saw, and who has been dead for, in at least as far as the movie is concerned, 60 years. And she gives up all of her powers to bring this guy back again on the wishing stone. Dream stone, great, whatever, it's fine. And
The Matrix and the Transformers is the best example.
Yeah, the Matrix of leadership, that's even better.
Oh my gosh, we so badly need to talk about that.
We don't.
We do. Yes.
She spends all of her time in this romance that was totally fine in World War I in 1917 or whatever, but it's 1984. You hate to say get over it to grieving people, but get the fuck over it. I feel like I could have said that in the 20s if I ran into Wonder Woman and I was good enough friends with her for her to tell me about her boyfriend who blew up in a plane. And she has to be talked into getting her powers back by said boyfriend, who again is brought back by the Dreamstone. And let's talk about that as well. Does Chris Pine's face ever actually seen by anybody in the movie? Or is that just a shortcut for the viewer?
I think it's a shortcut for the viewer and everyone
when
else.
When she looks at him,
engineering guy, Pine,
she's seeing this random dude who has been taken over by Chris Pine's soul. And his soul, I assume like Hodor and Bran, is just like cowering in a back corner of his brain, terrified at what's happening to him.
I think she sees her boyfriend and everyone else sees engineering guy, maybe, because it's her wish. I don't know, actually. Again, there's a lot of
totally
a lot of logical jumps. And the poor engineering man, where is he during all of this?
Yeah. Like, he's going to show up on a security video kicking the shit out of people in the White House. Secret Service is going to come knocking on his door like, you are causing a rumble. You're under arrest now, obviously. But, whatever. Maybe the cameras weren't installed at that point. What else? The whole thing, everything with Kristen Wiig, who plays, like, half of the bad guys. The movie does not understand what it has with her. Like, who is this character? She's the clumsy person who has low self-esteem, who wants to wish to be Diana. Okay, so I didn't watch a lot of Saturday Night Live when Kristen Wiig was a character on there, but I imagine some of her characters were people who were awkward, who embarrassed themselves trying to act more professional or more with it than they were. But
yeah, the movie gives her bad characters.
Yeah. The movie gave her no jokes. She has no jokes. And the movie also wants you to think that she's funny and clever without ever actually showing her be funny and clever. But they cast like a famous comedian for this role, and they can't like show her doing what she's best at.
I'm okay with that, because Will Ferrell did a movie that had no jokes, Stranger Than Fiction.
Sure.
And he was good in that. And I thought Kristen Wiig, outside of the terrible writing that was done, I thought she did a really adequate job of fulfilling that role. Once she got past when she started morphing into Cheetah, whatever, and got past like the. It was almost like high school style acting of tripping on your own heel.
Yeah.
Being like purpose nerd. That drives me crazy.
I just feel like there were jokes there. Like when she suddenly discovers that she's strong, I feel like that's a whole, there's a dozen laughs you could have pulled out of that, of her not realizing her own strength. And instead she's just packing weights onto a dumbbell or a barbell. And it's just the most unimaginative thing possible, which I think is just indicative of the movie. Again, it's 2.5 hours long, and we don't really understand what was happening in a good chunk of it.
I feel like our conversation about this movie is as disjointed as the actual movie is.
That's fair.
You just hop logical fallacy to strangeness and weirdness.
That's fair. I haven't listened to any podcast taking it apart like you have. It's really hard to imagine. Like, if I were to listen to a podcast about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, I have no doubt that I'm missing some nuance there, possibly, that might have made that movie better. It would be hard, if I were to go back, if I were to listen to the Kevin Smith thing you're talking about, I've listened to him talk about superhero movies before, and I think he takes them way too seriously. I think it's kind of sad.
It's okay. Yeah.
That's just kind of who that guy is. What else? I thought, like, the kid acting, I want to single out as especially terrible in this movie.
I told Chelsea the same thing. The kid never changes his face. And how did he find his way into the grassy area when the guy comes back on the helicopter?
I don't know.
And how did he come back on a helicopter?
I don't know. He's in like a nuclear bunker. And he just...
Where everyone left. And then all of a sudden...
This guy almost... Back. Everybody knows this guy almost... He's on like a universal transmitter. Everybody's watching him. Everybody knows that he almost directly led to the extinction of humanity. And
Wasn't it great timing that he went into the White House right as they were talking about this?
It sure was. Yeah, that was handy.
And they had those nice posters up describing it exactly, so they could just through the transfer of. And first of all, couldn't they have just made this movie in 2020 when that technology exists?
Instead
of 1984.
I mean, let's put a pin. Let's go. Yeah, let's. We're all over the place because there's so much to pick apart in this movie. Why is this movie set in 1984? Why? If you're not even going to have any 80s music in your movie, what are you doing? What is the point?
There's setting up a trilogy?
I don't know. She doesn't age. She's got the same job. I think she's got the same job in like Batman versus Superman. I haven't seen that movie. I could not be bothered to watch that movie. There's no connection to the broader universe, I don't think.
The Kevin Smith thing said it had to do with years. Like, you had to pick this based on other Marvel,
DC.
DC Universe movies. They didn't have to pick 84, but it had to be before something else. And so, but then they did a terrible job of actually using
it. I don't think any of that is in the movie. I think they really wanted to have a mall scene, and that's kind of all I got. Just costuming, I guess, but... That just makes your movie more expensive at the end of the day.
Right. Did you see, do you watch Stranger Things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, couldn't they have called up the mall people from Stranger Things to put that second scene together?
I would buy it's the same mall. That wouldn't shock me.
No, but I mean, the mall in Stranger Things looked more 80s. Like,
kids are like talking about things that are happening in the 80s and like movies that are coming out. There's very little sense of place in this movie, with the exception of like all of these glamour shots of DC. So good on them. No one's ever seen the Lincoln Memorial before. Yeah, you're right to say this conversation is disjointed because there's a lot of very strange choices. I want to get back to the terrible children. That's what I wanted to talk about.
The terrible children that wander out of the woods to the White House lawn or nearby.
That is only one example. Yeah. Alistair. Just one of many. Real quick on Alistair. He makes a wish. He gets the wind blown in his face. Nothing happens. I thought for sure that was going to be like the villain's undoing somehow, or he would have to walk back his goals to save his son or not. Nothing. Nothing came of that. Seemed pretty important because Max Lord really reacted to it, but nothing happened there. He was wrong to react. Other bad kids. I really can't stand it when child actors like mug for the camera, like thumbs up or give a wow face or any of that kind of bullshit. I fucking hate it. And that mall scene kind of only exists so we can get a kid actor mugging at Wonder Woman, so we can see. I'm gonna just assume that it's for like empowerment's sake. Like, look at this awesome woman kicking these men's asses. You go, girl. I hated it. I fucking hated that. And last bad kid actors, when Wonder Woman saves the two Egyptian children who are running out onto an active highway, not only are they not ideal child actors, but they are also clearly dummies. at a certain, if you're going to sub in children, stuntmen, which don't exist, but if you're going to involve them in a stunt, you need to do better on your dummy work, because Gal Gadot is pretty clearly holding mannequins whose joints are not bending as she is rolling on the pavement with them. This is a $200 million movie. It's not the worst thing in the world when, like, a $3 million horror movie splices in some bad effect, because it might be, like, a joke. It might be purposeful to, like, DIY horror roots, like, a tribute to that. You don't get to do that in a movie this big. Those things just leap out in such a way that instantly date the movie and indicate a level of sloppiness that just should not be allowed at this level.
It was $200 million or $300 million?
Yes, $200 million. If not, I mean, you could be right.
I don't know. They didn't get their money's worth for CGI. CGI was bad throughout.
Yeah, like, what do you spend all that money on? Just costuming, I suppose.
Invisible plane fireworks. That was a super important scene.
I guess. That was fine, I suppose. I don't know why they had to steal a fighter jet, of all things.
So it wouldn't have enough fuel to make it halfway across the world.
Yeah, again, architect is going to get multiple knocks on his door. He stole an F-16 and he was fighting in the White House. The guy's in trouble. He's going to be missing huge gaps in his memory. And he went on a wild globe-hopping save-the-world trip. What a fucking stupid, stupid movie. Real disappointing. I was really hoping that at the end of this terrible year that there would at least be, like, a silly disposable thing that people could enjoy, if not kind of together, because a lot of people have HBO Max, and that just was not the case at all. It was just as terrible and just as discouraging to, like, the state of the movies as every other part of 2020. I don't know. Maybe I saw it in, like, a period of seasonal affective disorder. But this, it was just depressing all the way through. Final thoughts? Anything we missed on Wonder Woman?
We could probably talk for an hour for things we missed that we could.
We could. Yeah, Diana, Wonder Woman in the closet, in the corner of her closet, has this, like, ancient Athenian artifact that's just lying around, and she dusts it occasionally when she's watching her security footage in her closet. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the shield that withstood the 300, but not one Catwoman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she said at some point she doesn't have a TV, and then later on she opens up a closet.
Liar.
Like 12 TVs.
Anyways,
this was bad. Another movie not to watch.
Yeah, a pretty lackluster trio, the Mediocre Movie Club, this last month. But I don't know. I had high hopes, frankly, on all these movies, and deeply disappointed by each and every one of them. Some less so, but the overall feeling is disappointment. Our final round of the movie game spit out number 1041, which is Gravity. So I'll say Sandra Bullock.
Oh, I thought I was going to say Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bullock is in Ocean 8.
Yeah, she is indeed. I'm trying to think which of the remaining seven you would know. Anne Hathaway? We'll take a shot on Anne Hathaway.
Oh, Anne Hathaway's in... Is she in The Princess Bride?
There you go.
Is it The Princess Bride? No,
she's not. She's in The Princess something.
That's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of Princess Diaries.
There it is. Julie Andrews is in The Princess Diaries.
Oh, Julie Andrews is in The Sound of Music.
So is Christopher Plummer.
Who? Christopher Plummer.
He's Baron Von Trapp.
I'm consulting my better half here.
Okay.
He's also in White Christmas.
You might be winning this round with your weird musical knowledge.
I don't No, I don't know if that's true or not. I'm guessing an old musical.
We'll never know.
You know, name Ewan in White Christmas?
I believe that is a movie. I certainly don't know anybody that's in it. I'll accept your victory for this round.
It's not, but he's not in it. There's no way. But you should think of the most famous person from all, like, 1950s,
60s. Oh, like Sinatra?
No.
If he's not in it, then we're not going to guess on it. I believe you, but he's not in it. Okay. I mean, I was a little nervous there for a second with Julie Andrews. I thought she was going to give me, like, I'm sure she was in some other weird 50s or 60s movie that your kids have seen a dozen times.
You know what we should do is we should just name movies, or I name a movie and see if you can't name a single person from it.
The next time it's just you and me on the Media Community Club podcast, we'll put a pin in that one. But in the meantime, you can check out my reviews of each of these previous three movies on MediaCommunity.club, and you can look forward to reading the next three reviews of hopefully better movies. For our next round for January, we're watching The King of Staten Island, which is newly available on HBO Now or HBO Max. Soul, which is the newest Pixar movie that was released directly to Disney Plus, and Gangs of New York for something completely different.
I'm still annoyed that got thrown in there.
Yeah, I would have. I've seen that movie many times, never written about it, so that'll be fun. But
aren't the other two are 2020 movies? Why don't we just throw that one out?
It's too late. We're locked in. The rules are ironclad. They can't be changed. Gangs of New York, I believe, is on Netflix. We will also be recording a podcast shortly about the best movies and probably TV as well, 2020. That'll be coming up shortly. The recording studio software is due for an upgrade. And once that gets upgraded, I'll be able to finish editing a podcast that myself and Pierce recorded about the recent release Mank, directed by David Fincher, as well as a ranking of all of David Fincher's movies. Check out the Side Pieces tab of our website to read some recent reviews, like reviews I posted for The Tree of Life and The Look of Silence, both movies that were very high on my Best of the Decade list, as well as one of my favorite movies from 2020, Les Miserables. And check us out on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movical and Instagram at Munich Movie Club. I'm John_Kissel on Letterboxd. Thank you for joining me tonight, Brian. Sorry we forgot to record the first 10 minutes or so, but I think we recovered nicely.
We got bonus time.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me tonight.
See ya.
Have a good night.